Side Door, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX. I'm Lizzie Peabody.
This is Apollo Saturn Launch Control. We are now at T-minus 8 hours, 58 minutes, and counting. We have a new weather forecast just came in. There will be a 30% chance of light showers at launch time.
Be looking for conditions on the morning of November 14th, 1969, were not ideal for a rocket launch.
It was a dark and stormy day. Which, I know, it feels like kind of a cliched way to start a story, but it was a very important part of this story.
This story is about Apollo 12, America's second manned mission to the moon. Nick Partridge, a spokesperson for the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, popped over to help me kick it off.
The front, which began passing through here late yesterday, is not expected to now move through by launch time. However, this is not going to be a constraint to launch as presently viewed.
You know, it's still kind of gloomy, still kind of raining, but the lightning strikes were far enough away. They weren't within the zone where you would worry about it hitting the rocket or anything, and they were going to go.
Crowds sheltered under ponchos and umbrellas at the Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral, Florida. President Nixon was there.
President Nixon to be the first president to watch a launch while in office.
Everybody waiting.
So countdown comes.
11, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, ignition.
They get to, you know, 3210, the rocket comes to life, and can't overstate the size and power, complexity, and danger associated with this rocket. It was the biggest, most complex machine by some measures ever built.
Ever.
Right. The liftoff goes without a hitch.
That's a lovely liftoff. That's not bad at all. Everything's looking great. Sky's getting lighter.
Everybody's good.
Looks good.
For a few seconds.
30 seconds.
36 seconds into the flight.
The hell was that?
Something happens.
What happens?
I just lost the platform. Okay, we just lost the platform, gang. I don't know what happened here. We had everything in the world drop out.
All of the systems go down. All of their indicators go haywire. All of the warning lights come on at once.
I got three fuel cell lights, an AC bus light, a fuel cell disconnect, AC bus overload, 1 and 2, main bus AC out.
A mile in the air and approaching the speed of sound, the crew was riding an almost dead spacecraft atop a 36-story rocket towards space with no idea what was wrong. So this time on Side Door, we commemorate that story for the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 12 launch, after a quick break.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Support for Smithsonian Side Door comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/sidedoor. That's odoo.com/sidedoor.
Let's back up. If you don't know much about the Apollo 12 mission, you're not alone. I knew nothing about it before beginning research on this episode, and that's partly because it's sandwiched between two very famous missions. Apollo 11.
That's one small step for man, one Diane Lee for mankind.
And Apollo 13.
Houston, we've had a problem.
It kind of gets overshadowed by its siblings.
Yeah, 12, a middle child, certainly, but a high-achieving one. Charming one. The reliable one. The funny one.
Jan Brady.
Yeah, yeah.
The Jan Brady of Apollo missions had an ambitious goal. Just 4 months earlier, Apollo 11, which we talked about in an episode just a few months ago, successfully landed on the moon, but missed their targeted landing site by about 4 miles. In the words of this 1969 ABC broadcast,
if man is to really explore, he has to be able to land exactly where he wants to.
This time, Apollo 12 would try to nail a pinpoint landing. The plan was to land right next to a lunar probe called Surveyor 3 that had been sent to the moon 2 years earlier.
So they thought the easiest way to demonstrate a pinpoint landing was to say, we're going to land at the Surveyor 3 landing site and potentially retrieve parts of the lander to bring back to Earth along with all of the moon rocks.
If they managed to bring those parts back, scientists could study how their equipment aged on the moon.
They have to land within 3,000 feet or they won't have enough oxygen to safely get to Surveyor and make it back.
That was the goal. But what really set Apollo 12 apart from any mission that came before it was the crew.
They were best friends.
Apollo 11 is a tough act to follow, but no astronauts were ever better picked for a mission than Pete Conrad, Dick Gordon, and Alan Dean. All Navy commanders and all old friends.
They were besties.
None of Apollo 12's crew is still living, so we talked to Nancy Conrad. Her husband, Pete Conrad, was commander of Apollo 12.
So what qualities made their friendship special? How would you describe their friendship?
What wove them together was the ability to just be who they were without strutting. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
There was huge respect, and each of them had extraordinary capabilities, and they each made room for each other's extraordinary capabilities.
The tone of any mission is set by its commander. But Pete Conrad was far from the straight-laced, typical NASA commander.
Spacecraft Commander Conrad, 39, veteran of Gemini 5 and 11, is funny, friendly, outspoken, and hard as nails when he has to be.
He liked to swear, crack jokes, and he hummed as he worked. At 5'6.5", he was one of the shortest astronauts at NASA, but he had a supersized personality.
Well, he was a wiry, high-energy piece of work. He was fun, really just fun. I mean, if you ever wanted to have a dinner party and make sure that everyone had a great time, you would invite Pete Conrad.
He was known to be the most fun-loving of them all while still being a really capable aviator.
Pete Conrad first met his command module pilot, Dick Gordon, or to Pete,
Dicky, as we call him,
in the Navy at test pilot training school. They were both ambitious, competitive pranksters, and they hit it off. After they both joined NASA, they spent 3 cramped days together in orbit on an earlier mission.
I guess there's really no other crucible that will forge a bond quite like that, right?
I guess not. But if Pete Conrad and Dick Gordon liked to be seen and heard, the third member of their crew definitely stood apart. That was Al Bean.
Al Bean was just one of the dearest human beings I've ever known.
He was a bit quieter, while some of the other guys were doing traditional astronaut adventure stuff, drinking or racing cars. He took painting lessons. He was a really capable pilot, but he wasn't known to be a self-promoter.
Pete Conrad had been Al's flight instructor in the Navy, and it was Pete who encouraged Al to apply to the astronaut program. He noticed that Al wasn't the most naturally gifted pilot, but he was definitely the hardest worker. He was a details guy. At NASA, Pete was tapped to lead an Apollo mission, but Al's quiet, hardworking demeanor landed him at a desk, playing a support role without any real hope of going to the moon. That is, until Apollo 12's assigned lunar module pilot, Cece Williams, died in an accident. And Pete came looking for his old student from flight school.
like the big broad brush strokes, the overview, the 30,000 foot visionary pieces. He was a vision person, not a process person. That's why he asked Al Bean to join the crew, because Al was a process person. Pete knew what he could do.
The NASA brass was skeptical. Al was not their first choice, but Pete Conrad insisted, and Al joined the mission.
So you end up with three people who all knew each other from the Navy. They were close like no other crew. They had matching gold Corvettes that they would race up and down the causeways in Cape Canaveral. And they actually had like their mission assignments painted on the side. They had commander and command module pilot and lunar module pilot on the side. And they would just go everywhere in these matching cars. Matching cars, can you imagine? As far as I know, there was no mission quite like Apollo 12, where everyone was just so close and so great, and it was gonna be a great mission, but they were also going to have the time of their lives flying it.
So on the rainy morning of November 14th, 1969, this dream team set off on their dream mission, which a few seconds in, looked more like a nightmare. We'll get back to the moment everything changed after the break.
That's a lovely liftoff. That's not bad at all. Everything's looking great. Sky's getting lighter.
Okay. It was a very nice liftoff. You know, my thought was, this is going to be a piece of cake. Didn't last very long.
On the morning of the launch, Apollo 12's flight director, Jerry Griffin, was on the ground at Mission Control, the room crammed full of guys in white shirts and black ties behind computers, making sure everything went according to plan. He was 34 years old, and for the first time in his life, he was in charge.
This was the first time that I had been a lead flight director, and was the first time I had been part of a Saturn launch.
Saturn V is the rocket designed to support NASA's Apollo program. It was flashy new technology at the time, and it's still the largest, most powerful American launch rocket ever built. What is the job of the flight director?
Well, a flight director was like the conductor of a symphony. You didn't play any of the instruments, but you had to make sure it all came out sounding right.
So when the whole orchestra's instruments simultaneously went silent, 36 seconds into the piece, it was Jerry's problem.
I heard some static, just a hard static. And then I heard Pete Conrad say something like, "What was that?"
"What the hell was that?"
Conrad started reading off all these caution and warning lights.
"I got 3 fuel cell lights, an 18-bus light, a fuel cell disconnect, 18-bus overload.
My first thought was, uh-oh, we're going to have to abort. I'm going to have to be the first guy that calls an abort of a Saturn launch, and it's my first time."
On top of being totally unprecedented, Jerry Griffin knew that aborting this early in the flight would be risky. The rocket was traveling at more than 600 miles per hour and accelerating, but it was still only about a mile in the air, lower than commercial airplanes fly. Aborting would mean that the command module, the little gumdrop on top of the rocket where the crew was sitting, would need to propel off the rocket.
It's a very violent ride, very sudden, high G-forces. Supposedly, the rocket would get you up high enough for the chutes to deploy in time to soften your landing in the water. But in that violent kind of situation, you never know whether that's going to work exactly right. So the higher you can get, you just have more time for the systems to work.
So the longer he could delay the call to abort the mission, the better.
You got to kind of swallow the panic. That's the secret, is don't let the fear or the panic take control of you.
Griffin took a deep breath and assessed the situation. Something had disabled the electrical systems in the command module, leaving the crew in the dark, without any way of knowing where in space they were heading.
They didn't have anything that was working inside the command module. So they really were flying blind.
Griffin had to figure out what was wrong fast. He got on the radio.
And I said, "ECOM, what do you see?"
My call sign was ECOM. And what that stood for was Electrical, Environmental, and Communications.
John Aaron, the 24-year-old ECOM, sat across the room at Mission Control. And what he saw was this.
All of a sudden, my console warning lights, probably 85% of that 100 lights, lit up like a Christmas tree. Bam! It went from being perfect to a can of worms in a second. My responsibility was to come up with some kind of recommendation of what to do.
Aaron's monitors froze.
But the values that they froze at was this nonsensical, random kind of numbers. And I thought, what is that?
And then he remembered. A year earlier, he was watching a ground test in Houston when the monitor did something very similar. Nobody knew what to do at the time, but John Aaron took the data home and studied it. He realized the problem could be fixed by flipping a tiny switch on the control panel, the SCE switch. By flipping it from the normal power source to auxiliary or backup power source, they could get their data back. At the time, he just thought, huh, interesting.
I then forgot about it.
Fast forward 1 year.
And lo and behold, there it was. That pattern was there.
So when Jerry Griffin asked John Aaron,
"ECOM, what do you see?"
I said, "Try SCE to aux."
And I looked at him and I crunched up my face. I didn't say it on the loop, but I said, "What?" I'd never heard of the switch. SCE to aux.
I guess I said it so matter-of-factly that he didn't even question it. He just said, "Capcom."
I turned to the Capcom.
Capcom is the single point in the Mission Control Center that's authorized to talk to the crew in those days.
And I said, "Capcom, tell him SCE to aux." And he kind of said, "What?"
You know, SCE to aux, auxiliary. So that got radioed up.
Conrad repeated it. He said, "NCE to aux." And then he said,
"What the hell is that?
What the hell is that?
Huh? What the hell is that?"
It was a switch that none of us had ever used in a simulation. There were hundreds of switches in that cockpit. But Al Bean,
he says, "I know where that is."
He knew where it was.
Now, thank God, Al Bean knew where that was.
And he got it, went to auxiliary, and when we did, we got our data back.
Al Bean, the details guy, knew exactly where that switch was. With the data back at Mission Control, they could see that some kind of charge had knocked the fuel cells offline, but the rocket was still flying on course. Miraculously, whatever had disrupted the electrical system in the command module hadn't thrown off the navigational system in the Saturn V rocket. Pete Conrad had a theory about what might have done it.
"I'm not sure we didn't get hit by lightning."
He said, "I'm not so sure we didn't get hit by lightning," and he was right. We found out later there were two lightning strikes.
They say lightning doesn't strike the same place twice. But it turns out Apollo 12 wasn't just struck by lightning. It created its own lightning. Twice. How wild is that? Jan Brady, meet Zeus.
Think of it like this. When the Saturn lifts off, you've got 7.5 million pounds of thrust, and you've got a fire trailing behind it that's extremely long. It ionized all of that heat below the rocket and took the potential electric field that existed in those clouds, and it actually created a short to the ground.
In other words, those clouds were primed for lightning, and Apollo 12 acted as a kind of spark.
Who would have ever thought of that? It was a complete surprise to me.
It was a surprise to everyone, and it was a heck of a lesson to learn the hard way. Because of it, NASA made a rule. From then on, they'd measure the electrical potential in the atmosphere before any launch, even under blue skies. But back aboard Apollo 12, only 2 minutes and 22 seconds into the adventure of a lifetime, the crew was relieved.
I think we need to do a little more all-weather testing.
Amen.
A couple of cardiac arrests down here, too, Pete.
God darn almighty.
They started to feel more comfortable, and we could tell that because they were making jokes and giggling. They were giggling between each other.
That was something else. I never saw
any light on the floor, so many lights up there I couldn't read them all.
And then he got tickled.
When Pete was afraid, he would giggle.
And he literally laughed all the way into orbit.
Jerry Griffin cleared Apollo 12 to continue to the moon, and the crew hunkered down for the voyage, radioing, "Well, Houston, we've settled into a normal routine." They listened to Elvis as Earth got smaller and smaller in the command module window.
Apollo 12, after that call, was one of the cleanest missions we had in the whole program.
5 days later, Pete Conrad steered the final descent to the surface of the moon, with Al Bean assisting him.
There it is. There it is. Son of a gun, right down the middle of the road. Outstanding, man.
And they stuck that pinpoint landing. From the lunar lander, Pete Conrad radioed, "Boys, you'll never believe it."
"Boys, you'll never believe it. Look what I see sitting on the side of the crater.
The old surveyor,
right? The old surveyor, yes, sir." "Does that look neat? It can't be any further than 600 feet from here."
Exactly as they planned, they'd landed close enough to Surveyor 3 to just walk right over to it. And when Pete Conrad, the third man to walk on the moon, stepped down from the lander, the first thing he said was,
"Whoopee!
Whoopee!
Whoopee!"
Then, in true Pete Conrad fashion, he cracked a joke about his short legs.
"Man, that may have been a small one for Neil, but that's a long one for me."
"That may have been a small one for Neil, but that's a long one for me." During their 31 hours and 40 minutes on the moon, Pete Conrad and Al Bean gathered moon rocks, installed seismometers, and conducted other experiments. And they had so much fun doing it that one Missourian griped to NASA in a letter, "Astronaut Conrad gives the impression that he is on a joyride of no significance whatsoever."
"Hey, Al, can work out here all day. Just take your time."
"Yeah, he was a hummer. And, oh, God, he used to sing. And he had a terrible voice."
Before returning to Earth, Pete and Al moonwalked over to Surveyor 3 and cut a camera off of it, physical proof of the precision landing. Scientists back home were eager to investigate how solar radiation had aged it on the surface of the moon. And today, non-scientists, like me, can check it out too.
So you're looking at the camera. It's a television camera from the Surveyor 3 lander.
I visited the camera with Matt Schindel, space historian and curator of planetary science at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. I guess I'm going to try to describe it, but it's hard to describe because I've never seen anything shaped like this before. It's like a, well, sort of like an amputated robot arm. You can see frayed wires where Pete and Al used moon bolt cutters to chop it off the lander. And even today, it's covered in fine gray moon dust. That's why it's sealed in a glass case.
Because it is still classified as a lunar sample, so that if NASA wants to take it back and study it again in their, you know, clean facilities, they can do that. But this is the first example, and still the only example, of a probe that's been sent to another world where humans have met up with it and brought pieces back from it.
That's pretty cool. Apollo 12 was a success. The crew's precise landing proved that future targeted exploration on the moon would be possible. They advanced the work of Apollo 11, spending more time on the surface and completing more experiments. But Matt says that they also ensured the Apollo program would continue.
If Apollo 12 had failed, that could have been the end of the Apollo program, just because Nixon was very worried that there would be an Apollo failure, and that if there was an Apollo failure, it would happen, you know, during his presidency.
And it almost did fail. Nobody knows that better than Jerry Griffin.
There's no doubt that 12, it could have gone either way. Could have ended up with three fatalities, or it could have ended up the way it did.
It ended up going really well. And ultimately, that's the reason people don't talk about it much. After surviving lightning, the crew accomplished a flawless moon landing. And in the end, the crew is what makes Apollo 12 special.
They just liked each other. And they had fun with each other, and you could see it, and you could hear it. You know, we had different crews. All the personalities were a little different. But I can tell you, the 12 crew was one of the most fun of all the bunch.
This was a friendship that was, by definition, I think, extraordinary, because not many best friends get to go to space together.
Not exactly. And stay best friends.
Right.
Go in best friends, come out best friends. Their entire lives. It's extraordinary.
Today, Pete Conrad, Dick Gordon, and Al Bean are buried close together at Arlington National Cemetery. The three extraordinary astronauts who 50 years ago survived near disaster, went to the moon, came back, and had the time of their lives doing it. You've been listening to Side Door, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX. If you'd like to see photos of the Surveyor 3 camera that the Apollo 12 crew brought back from the moon, it's in our newsletter. Subscribe at si.edu/sidedoor. There's also a link in our episode notes. You know what I say every time someone leaves us a review on Apple Podcasts?
Whoopee.
Whoopee! Because reading a lovely review is my version of walking on the moon. Side Door is made possible with help from people like you. Your generous support helps make all the amazing work you hear about at the Smithsonian possible. Special thanks to Nick Partridge and Matt Schindel of the National Air and Space Museum, who also co-host the podcast Airspace. If you haven't heard it, it's great. Check it out. Thanks as well to Nancy Conrad, John Aaron, and Jerry Griffin. And thanks to Andrew Chaikin, whose book, A Man on the Moon, The Voyages of the Apollo Astronauts, informed a lot of our research for this episode. Our podcast team is Justin O'Neill, Jason Orfanin, Michelle Harvin, Caitlin Schaefer, Jess Sadek, Lara Koch, and Sharon Bryant. Episode artwork is by Greg Fisk. Extra support comes from John, Jason, and Genevieve at PRX. Our show is mixed by Tarek Fuda. Our theme song and other episode music are by Breakmaster Cylinder. If you want to sponsor our show, please email sponsorship@prx.org. I'm your host, Lizzie Peabody. Thanks for listening. Aaron's monitors froze.
I mean, there's only so many ways you can read that, yeah.
Aaron's monitors. What did they do? They froze.
That's not
what did they do? They froze like ice. What did they do? They froze.
Okay, stop.
Damn it. Okay.
Top of eight.
Support for Smithsonian Side Door comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/sidedoor. That's odoo.com/sidedoor.